And so if you want to have more aha moments, if you want to have more inspiration, then the first step is to really dig in and become specialized, because that's when you'll start having these nuanced, sort of interesting aha moments that can lead to future products and hopefully commercial success.
That's Alan Gannett, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Alan Gannett is the founder and CEO of TrackMaven, a software analytics firm whose clients include Microsoft, Marriott, Honda, and GE, just to name a few. He's been on the 30 Under 30 list for both Inc. and Forbes. He joins us to talk about his book, The Creative Curve: How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. Alan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You begin this book with an examination of creativity and the myths that have grown up around it. What have we gotten wrong about creativity?
So the book is split up into two halves, and the first half is this sort of mythbusters on the ideas of creativity, and the second half is some practical things you can do to actually get better at it. And in the first half, what I did is I talked to all the leading academics who study creativity, I interviewed creative geniuses and creative greats, and I tie it all together with the history of creative thought over time. And the thing which is so interesting is that our current notion of creativity, this sort of, I call it the inspiration theory of creativity, that there are some people who are born with these amazing skills to come up with great ideas, has really taken a hold in our culture. And we see it in magazines and movies, you know, ranging from the movie Amadeus to, you know, any copy of Fast Company has, you know, some singular genius on the cover. And this has really become our notion of creativity. And the issue is that this idea that creativity is this sort of divinely inspired fixed asset is scientifically completely wrong. We've been studying creativity for the last 40 years across psychology, sociology, anthropology, neuroscience. And what you find when you actually look at the science behind creativity is that creativity is a nurturable, learnable skill. It's not something that's the result of a genetic lottery. It's not the truth that people are popping out of the womb playing the piano. The truth is that what you find is that oftentimes people start specializing very young, and by the time they're adults, they've been already practicing a creative skill for 10, 15 years, and it seems like they're amazing, and it seems like they have this natural talent, but they might have been practicing for, you know, 10 or more years. And so the reality around creativity is that it is something you can get better at if you have the right method.
In the beginning of the book, you tell the story of Paul McCartney and writing the song Yesterday. How does that illustrate what you were just telling me about?
When we talk about creativity, there's these stories that have sort of become pegged in our culture. So one of the famous ones is, you know, Paul McCartney with the song Yesterday. So Yesterday is the most recorded song in history, so it's a big song. And the story goes that he was dreaming, and he woke up from a dream, and he had the song Yesterday composed in his head. He literally dreamed up this song that went on to be the most recorded song of all time. And this is an amazing story and shows us that creativity is, you know, this province of the genius, except it's complete fluff. The reality of it is that Paul McCartney dreamed up six notes to the melody, and he then spent 20 months finishing the song. He actually was obsessed with this song. The other Beatles and his manager started getting annoyed with him because everywhere they would go, he kept working on this song over and over and over again. And he also, there's a sort of famous little anecdote where he only dreamed up a couple notes. He didn't dream up the full song or the lyrics. And the actual lyrics he used as placeholder lyrics for a long time were lyrics about scrambled eggs, because someone once offered him scrambled eggs while he was practicing it. And so this really was the result of a lot of hard, intentional, thoughtful work over 20 months that went on to become the song Yesterday that we know. And so there's this notion that, you know, these creative flashes are these sudden light bulbs. But the reality is far from it. You know, J.K. Rowling, you know, the story goes, was hit with the idea for Harry Potter when she was on a train and started scribbling it on a napkin. And the reality with her is she had the idea for the character Harry Potter and some of his sidekicks, and she didn't have a napkin. And she then spent 5 years working on the first book. She once showed an interviewer in a TV interview a box of all 15 variations of chapter one that she had. And so we have these stories of these lightning bolt moments, of these light bulb moments, of these flashes of genius, and they're almost all exaggerated.
You engaged in a quest to find out how creativity really works, and you talk with a wide variety of people, people in business, people in the arts. Tell us more about your research process.
Yeah. So what I did is, in addition to talking to the academics in the space and, you know, consuming lots and lots of the peer-reviewed research, and there's a lot on creativity, actually. One of my fun little things I discovered was that there's a field of study called the study of greatness, which I think is a wonderful name to be a professor of. And I then interviewed 25 living creative greats. So these are people across a huge variety of industries. So everyone from Pasek and Paul, the songwriting duo who did, you know, the lyrics of La La Land and the music of Dear Evan Hansen and The Greatest Showman, to, you know, folks like Ted Sarandos, the chief content officer of Netflix, to David Rubenstein, the billionaire co-founder of the Carlyle Group, Nina Jacobson, the producer of The Hunger Games. So a really eclectic mix of folks. And what was so interesting from these interviews was that even though these people came from different industries, like I interviewed startup people, I interviewed stand-up comedians, across all these different industries, they actually followed the same patterns to become more creative. It wasn't that this was some, you know, divinely inspired thing, but again and again, I heard these stories of a lot of long, hard, thoughtful work.
So as a result of all that research, you came up with a four-step process for developing ideas, which you describe in your book. Tell us about those. What are those four steps?
Basically, I found these four patterns that appeared in 100% of the creatives I interviewed. The first one is that we talk about, you know, creatives as always these, you know, doers, as almost an opposition to consumers who just consume culture. You know, creators create. But one of the things I found is that actually these great creatives are always big, huge, massive consumers of the culture, of the creative products with which they operate. They go very, very, very deep. They know everything about the space. And so I talk about why that is and the neuroscience behind why actually having prior knowledge is so important to the creative process. And so that's the first law, I call it, the law of consumption. The second one is that, you know, we talk a lot about creativity as this thing that's all about newness, it's all about innovation, but actually what creativity is really about is the blend of the familiar and the new. We don't just like ideas that are radically new. We don't want to watch a movie that's 12 hours long and doesn't have a protagonist. You know, the ideas that tend to take hold in our culture are the ones that are a blend of the familiar and the new. Think, you know, the first Star Wars was a Western, but it was in space. Harry Potter is a very normal rags-to-riches orphan story, but there's wizards. And so since the blend of the familiar and the novel is important, the second law is that of imitation. These great creatives all imitate the other creatives who've come before them, and that's part of how they learn how to use these familiar structures and baselines with which to create their own novelty on top of. The third law is that of creative communities. So we talk of these creatives as, you know, these solo geniuses. We put their faces on covers. But the reality is that these great creatives, one of the things they do that separates them from aspiring creatives, is they build a community around them of the people who help actually support them and get them to the creative achievement that they've gotten to. And so in the book, I outline the different types of people you want in your creative community and the methods to actually getting them. And the fourth and final one is the law of iteration. So we talk about creatives as, you know, going to a writing cabin and writing their great American novel and only coming out once they write the words, the end. But the reality is that the great creatives, they understand that part of the creative process is about that relationship with the audience. They actually are not creating just for quote-unquote themselves. That's something aspiring creatives say. The best creatives know that the audience is what they want resonance with. And so they constantly are getting feedback from the audience throughout the creative process and iterating on their work along the way, rather than keeping it all internal. That's part of how they refine their product to get it right. So those are the four things I found that all these creators, whether you're a stand-up comedian or a chef, they all do.
You know, coming back to the example of the Beatles, you write that they weren't just always just doing their own thing and trying to satisfy themselves. They were very keenly aware of when they wrote their songs, exactly who those songs were targeted toward.
Yeah, I mean, the Beatles are great examples of, you know, very intentional songwriters. They talk about in interviews how they aim to create hits. They were very diligent about changing their styles to always, you know, stay relevant and, you know, not become too stale and over familiar, but have that right blend of the familiar and the novel. And so, you know, when you look at these stories, these great creators are not the stories of, you know, random chance. They're the stories of real intentionality.
Well, let's talk about how your readers can use this, because not everyone's going to be creating a television show or creating the next internet sensation. How do we use this in our everyday lives?
One of the big themes of the book is that there's this distinction between technical skill and timing. oftentimes what we get confused about when it comes to creativity is we think, well, you just have to be very, very skilled. But that's actually very different than timing. You know, I could paint a very great replica of the Mona Lisa, but it wouldn't be creative because it's a replica. But okay, that's interesting. So then what is creativity? Well, it turns out that what academics call creativity are things that are both novel, but also things that are valuable. Value is a social phenomenon. We have to agree that something's valuable for it to be valuable. And the things that we tend to think are valuable in society, it turns out, are the ideas that are a blend of the familiar and the novel. And so oftentimes what people get wrong in any profession, whether, for example, it's IT, they look for the product that's the most advanced, that has the most features, the most bells and whistles. But then when they actually implement that new software system, they're shocked that people don't use it. Because for people, it's too new. It's too much stuff. They don't need all of that. They don't want all of that. And so whether you're in a profession which you think is creative or not, one of the fundamental things for you to understand is that your job is to create things that people will use and want, not to create things that are just the technically most proficient or the most skilled. That's actually different than creating the right idea at the right time.
Looking at your own career and the success that you've had, do you think that you intuitively incorporated these principles into how you approached your work that helped you be successful?
Yeah, so it's interesting because I started this startup about 6 years ago. It's grown quite a bit. And, you know, the startup really came out of a problem I was having in my own life. And I was a marketer. I was a CMO of another company. And I realized that there was this big gap in the need for marketing analytics. And because I was so ingrained in the industry, I was able to see this very nuanced white space and create this thing. But obviously, I wouldn't have created this if I wasn't so deep in that little field. And so this is one of those things that people always find sort of surprising or shocking. They're like, well, you know, I want to have more light bulb moments. Well, people have light bulb moments about things they know about. And so if you want to have more aha moments, if you want to have more inspiration, then the first step is to really dig in and become specialized, because that's when you'll start having these nuanced, sort of interesting aha moments that can lead to future products and hopefully commercial success.
Alan, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Alan Gannett's book is The Creative Curve: How to Develop the Right Idea at the Right Time. You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. On Facebook, you'll find us at KPR Conversations. That's all one word. You can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. And you can sign up for the Conversations podcast on iTunes. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.